Good morning, it's Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Welcome, everybody. In our continuing look at this coming election, we know that the Baltimore Circuit Judges are also in a contest. The six of the sitting judges are running for election, and there are two people opposing them. And so we are lucky to have the three other judges here this part of our program, and we'll have three others joining us for the second part of the program that we recorded the other week because they have busy schedules in court and jumped out on their lunch hour to talk to us, and they got to jump back to the bench. So we're here with Judge Shannon Avery, Associate Judge of the Baltimore City Circuit Court, 8th Judicial District, as they all are. She's a member of the Court Operations Committee and the State Commission on Criminal Sentencing Policy. Judge Michael DiPietro, who also an associate judge on the Circuit Court, and Judge Cynthia Jones, also associate judge on the Baltimore Circuit Court. Good to have the three of you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having
Thank you,
us.
Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
So this election, if you're elected, it's for 15 years?
15-year term.
Is that right?
Correct.
So most judges, except for Billy Murphy back in 1980 when he ran, I remember that campaign very well, are usually appointed. So what are your thoughts, just very quickly, about this whole notion of running for office as a judge?
Well,
Shannon Avery.
Thank you very much. And thanks for asking. It's the judicial election is an interesting election because frequently people go into the voting booth and they are asked to vote for judges, and most of them really don't know who we are. So I will tell you that this ticket of sitting judges has been out in the community since May of last year, meeting people, going to community meetings. All summer we went to all the festivals and outdoor music events and really introduced ourselves to the voters, and we are continuing to do so. There is a real value in having judges in the community, and what we've found is that people are responding really well to meeting us and getting to know more about what we do in the circuit court. And I think that we are doing our part to lessen the sense of intimidation that people feel when they come into circuit court.
I'm going to come to that point about intimidation. You'll have thoughts on that as well before we move on to other issues that you face?
Well, I think you would know that historically the
Cynthia
reason
Jones.
We had elections was because there was a lack of diversity on the bench. Some of the members of our former bench who are now retired actually challenged people who were sitting on the bench because they were not – they did not make the shortlist through the vetting process. Mm-hmm. I think now our bench has benefited from not only the fact that we have elections, but because we have the vetting process and an expansion of specialty bars. So now our bench looks more like our community.
As you well know, there are a number of bills introduced this year in Annapolis.
Right. There's a bunch of them.
That seek to change the structure of the circuit court election system. And I guess people of goodwill can disagree whether the system should change or not change. I think one of the benefits, at least whether it be an election or a retention election, is the fact that we have gotten out into the community to places that perhaps I would have not gone to but for this race. And I've met a number of people that I otherwise probably wouldn't have met had I not been participating in this race. So I think those interactions have made me a better person and a better judge. And quite frankly, it's made me very bullish on the future of our city because we've met so many really engaged people in our broader community of whom I was not aware.
So I'm going to come back to the point you just made here. Okay. Let me ask a couple of questions that I know that are sticking – that are facing the judges at this moment. And one of them we've had on for the last 20 years or so, Doug Colbert from the Baltimore Carey School of Law, mm-hmm. the University of Maryland. And one of the issues that they have been talking a lot about and his students wrote about in The Sun was war on forgiveness. And from their argument when he was on the show like a few weeks back talking about some other issues and this issue came up, he was saying that, you know, we have most prosecutors, public defenders, the police all saying we really need to find a way to have warrant forgiveness because thousands of people are being arrested for not showing up to court and for many minor things that they would never get arrested for. Now they're spending a month in jail
or more waiting to see a judge again, and that the only stumbling block is the judges from supporting that idea that we should have warrant forgiveness. So how do you respond to that?
I'm somewhat familiar with what Doug is speaking to. I don't know if the judges are a stumbling block to this. I don't know if Doug is proposing legislation or just policy changes, but I can speak for myself. When I was in the criminal rotation, yes, there would be times, particularly on the misdemeanor docket, where people would not appear. And the judge is left with victims and witnesses who were there, but the defendant has not appeared. So, yes, there's the option to issue a summons or a warrant. I have repeatedly told defense attorneys that I will issue a warrant. However, if you make contact with your client, bring him here tomorrow. We'll square this up immediately. So, at least from my perspective, that is something judges can do to ameliorate the effect of a bench warrant on someone. Sometimes,
but that's after charges.
Yes, I mean, this is what Doug is speaking to, after charges.
Right. So, I guess what they're talking about here, in this particular point, which I've been reading a lot about, which is that failure to appear, people put out a bench warrant, and that the vast majority, they're arguing, that of these people who get these failure to appear bench warrants are there for misdemeanors, you know, not paying to get on the Amtrak, or they're not usually like serious crimes. And not things they would go to jail for. And so there are thousands of people in our community who have these warrants, most of them poor, most of them black, and that there should be – the argument should be a program where they have a place where they can come in, get it squashed and dealt with, and not have to worry about going to jail, losing their jobs, and being put in jail waiting for court. And that there must be a better way to do this than filling our jails up with people who have misdemeanors and small crimes. And then the head of the jail commented on that too. We'd love to have this happen. Then we wouldn't have so many people crowding our prisons or jails.
Yeah. So I'm not really clear on what you're proposing. But years ago, and it wasn't that long ago, they had an initiative in the city called Safe Surrender, where people who had nonviolent outstanding warrants, which would include FTA warrants, were able to turn themselves in into a safe environment. They actually used Bethel AME Outreach Center and New Metropolitan Baptist Church across the street. And that was one of the ways with which they were able to get rid of that warrant backlog without it resulting in arrest. There were some people who had felony warrants who turned themselves in and were subsequently arrested. That was a federal program based on a federal grant that was secured by the Baltimore Police Department. There are a host of warrants, but it requires a lot of manpower to work through those warrants and get them resolved. But I think if each agency dedicated their resources to doing so, it could happen, particularly for the minor offenses where you probably wouldn't put them in jail anyway.
Right.
And also for FTA warrants that we issue in circuit court, people do turn themselves into circuit court, and they're promptly presented to a judge. And so maybe I'm just not clear what
I generally don't issue them. When I had the misdemeanor docket, I waited, basically, because there are a whole host of reasons why people don't get to court.
Right.
And there's more work in recalling the warrant because they show up at 11:45 in the morning than there is to wait and be patient for them to come to court.
Right. Mark, if I can,
go ahead,
I think this is I wish I knew more about Doug's study than I do, but perhaps this is more of a problem or issue in the district court as opposed to the circuit court for Baltimore City. I'm not suggesting it is or it isn't, but I do believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that there is a warrant, I'd say forgiveness program, but that there's a method to resolve outstanding warrants in the district court. I believe Judge Morrissey wrote about this recently in an op-ed piece. It may not be enough. It may need some improvements. But I think the notion – I mean, I'm not suggesting – I know Doug and I like him.
I would be surprised to hear that the judiciary would be opposed to any reasonable programming to eliminate the backlog of warrants.
But I think when by the time we talk to the next three, I'll find out more about that to see.
Oh, great.
But since we can kind of put that away, okay. I think that what they want to do is create a warrant forgiveness program where people for nonviolent misdemeanor offenses could appear with a court clerk, get a new court date, and eliminate their vulnerability to arrest. That was the argument being made. But so, what do you all think, though, about the whether it is questions of bail? And I know bail comes up more in other courts, but it does come up in yours twice a week, and those things are part of the circuit court. And that there's been a lot of controversy over bail, and how you decide who gets what bail and for how much. I mean, you had this House Senate committee that studied this. I think some of you might have been on that committee. At least some judges were. Whether you all were or not, I'm not sure. But anyway, they made these recommendations that there should be no – we should do away with the money bail system when it comes to bail bonds companies and have a system where we can determine – judges can determine who should get bail and for how much and let the courts do all that. So if your bail is $100,000, you can put up 10% to the court and go home or whatever that is. So – and then, of course, the state legislature promptly decided to ignore all the recommendations that this commission came up with. So, what about that, though? Your discretion as judges, because a bail of $500 for somebody who's poor might as well be $500,000.
Well, so I will tell you that when I was a district court judge, I had.
I forgot you were also a district court judge.
Yeah, so we handled, I think the district court handles 95% or more of the bail reviews, and very few of those. Very few bails actually come up to circuit court. But I will tell you that as a district court judge, when I had the responsibility of doing bail reviews, there are considerations. And you have to take each case as individual on its merits, and not – it's not our job to consider the totality of the bail review system. But as individuals appeared before me, as they do before district court judges, you consider the nature of the charges, the severity of the charges, whether there's violence involved and whether the person is potentially a risk to public safety. And primarily, you consider the likelihood that the person will appear in court. And you have to weigh all of those considerations in light of the individual factors and facts that are presented to you in each case.
And in circuit court, we do that with the assistance of pretrial. So there is actually an individual from the pretrial office where they do the background. Does this person have aliases? Does this person have an alternate date of birth? Does this person have an FTA history? Do they have an FTA for a violation of probation? Do they have an FTA for a case that's in court? So they do that evaluation, and they present those factors to the court, and they make a bail recommendation. Then the defense attorney tells the court about their ties to the community, their relationship with their family, whether they're likely to come to court, who will be responsible for them. And then there are a whole host of alternatives, like putting them on electronic monitoring, and then the state makes their recommendation, and hopefully we're making an informed decision where we're considering all those factors and the input of both the state and the defense.
I just want to underscore that the listeners need to know that, as Judge Avery said, really I think 95% is probably conservative. Probably like 98% of all bail decisions are made in district court. Those who seek to have a review of that bail can ask the circuit court to review the bail. Typically, such motions are granted if there has been a change in circumstance from the time of the district court bail review to the filing, such as a perfect example would be at the time of the district court bail review, there were a number of outstanding criminal cases against this person, but they have all been resolved in that person's favor. Though people that have such change in circumstances, another example, the state's attorney has reduced the charges between then and now. For people who fall into those categories, they will get a bail review in circuit court, and it's effectively a do-over. I was assigned to that duty last year. In addition, there's the right to seek habeas corpus relief, which is effectively a challenge that I'm being held unconstitutionally. And what we need to do in those cases is look to determine whether or not the district court erred in making its habeas decision. So if we grant the habeas relief, again, the person would get a hearing in circuit court. But the fact of the matter is, and just anecdotally, it's what, Tuesdays and Fridays.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, two or three matters on Tuesday, two or three matters on Friday, typically.
They come before your courts.
Yes.
And on defense's motions.
On defense motions.
Right.
So let me ask you through this question. Just take a step back for just a second before
sure.
I ask this other question. It might be good for our listeners, we didn't do this at the top, but what's the difference for the people? Because maybe people don't know. You're running here to be – you were appointed originally by the governor. So you're running for this term that gives you 15 more years on the bench. But the difference between what you do in the district – what's the difference between circuit court and district court? You're running for circuit court. Somebody just quickly describe that so our listeners can get that as we're talking about this.
Okay. So in district court, the judges hear matters that are misdemeanor criminal, parking tickets, traffic docket, the protective orders, peace orders, and civil matters that are of a value less than $30,000. So you have auto torts and contract issues. There's the number of cases that fall in those categories are vast. But in circuit court, I think primarily the hallmark is that you have a right to a jury. So there are civil cases that are of a value of $30,000 or more. You have misdemeanors that have been prayed up from district court as well as all felonies. We also do the family docket, which includes divorce and child custody and appeals in and also first-time filed protective orders. We also handle juvenile and children in need of assistance matters.
And juvenile rotates among you, right?
We rotate through all of the divisions.
Right.
And then the district court judge is appointed to a 10-year term, and they're confirmed by the Senate after appointment by the governor. The circuit court judges are appointed by the governor and then run for a 15-year term. So the way I look at it is it's a bifurcated process. We have been vetted by our peers. We have been appointed by the governor, and we have been confirmed by the community.
So coming back to some of the issues that really concern a lot of people that have been come on the show, that have come up on my program over the years. And one is a very tough one to ask, but a bunch of these are, which is that the judges are too close to the police, that they take the police officer's word as gospel, and even though there have been many, many times we've seen the opposite be true. And given this time we're in, where a lot has been called into question, and it's a very complex question, but a lot has been called into question about stops, about violence, about what's happening in the communities, about the relationship between the community and the police, which is deteriorated beyond where it's been, I think, in decades, even though it's never been great in some places in decades. So what about this idea that you have a penchant to accept what the police say as the gospel truth?
Well, I'm a former city prosecutor, and I served as a prosecutor in Baltimore City for 15 years. And I think the judge's role is to assess the credibility of all witnesses who appear before him. And that's our reality. The benefit of having been a city prosecutor is you're not only familiar with the people who practice in front of you, meaning the state's attorney and the defense attorneys, you're familiar with the professional witnesses, and you're also familiar with the stories, right, and the realities. The other thing that I think is important that we all bring together as this ticket is we know we know the realities of the streets. We know what happens and what can happen. So we're able to discern the credibility of all witnesses who come before us, including our professional witnesses.
Just to kind of bifurcate this a little bit, as you well know, most of the criminal cases that are tried in the circuit court are tried by juries. So ultimately, in terms of determining someone's guilt or innocence, it's the jurors that really make that credibility decision, not the judges. I think what you're speaking to is perhaps in the province of, let's say, pretrial motions. So let's assume there's a motion to suppress evidence that was seized from a person based on an allegation that that person's constitutional rights were not followed. In those instances, yes, judges are asked to some extent to make credibility decisions. I have to say the suggestion that I or one of my colleagues believe the police over others, I find that not to be the case. But by the same token, we often see cases such as this, motions such as this, where there is no evidence presented by the defense. So you're only left with the testimony of a police officer. I can give you some, you know, I mean, there's plenty of stories where people have testified in their own defense, and
even in those cases, we make credibility findings.
Yes.
And you know, I think people forget that we live in Baltimore City. We live in these communities, and we had professional careers before we became judges, and we're not dumb. Like, we understand that people tell the truth, people lie, and it really doesn't matter whether someone is wearing overalls or a suit and tie or a uniform. It is our job, and we take an oath to be fair and impartial and to make those credibility findings on a case-by-case basis. And I will tell you that I am confident that I and all of my colleagues are upholding the oath that we took, which is, again, to be fair and impartial, and that is what we do.
And we're not immune from what goes on in the community. I mean, we're active in our communities. We live in our communities. We don't come to work from the county or, you know, from the surrounding community. And I go to church in West Baltimore. I'm on the 1300 block of Druid Hill Avenue three nights a week. I started my career in Cherry Hill. I live by the Northwood Shopping Center, okay, where when I pick up my prescription at the Rite Aid, there are young men there doing things that look unsavory. So the reality is, when those facts come before us, we're not immune from what we see, just like, you know, jurors see in their communities.
We were talking earlier before we went into the studio here about Michelle Alexander's book. Talking about the mass incarceration of people of color and black men specifically in this country. I think the stat is nationwide. I don't know how it plays out in Maryland. It would be interesting to know that. Wouldn't be hard to figure out. But 0.06% of the world's population of 7 billion people are African American. 25% of the world's prison population are African Americans, which is a pretty stunning number to me. So what role do you have in this as judges? I mean, I know you don't make policy, but you have a huge role. I mean, you are the heartbeat of the judicial system. You're the local judges. You're the ones who decide, you know, whether a human being goes to jail or doesn't go to jail, or have to pass sentence once the jury makes its decision. So I mean, so what about them? How much does that come into play, and what is that? How does that? What does that mean to you, that reality about our justice system that you are an integral part of, the linchpin to? In many ways.
Well, I can tell you, and I can probably speak for my colleagues, it gives me no pleasure to send a young person to jail for any lengthy period of time. But there are some cases that require that sort of punishment, typically cases that involve violence and people who have repeatedly been convicted of crimes of violence. I think we all owe it a duty to our community to protect one another from people that could harm others. I think if you look on the broad spectrum, I don't have statistics to support this, but the vast majority of cases that we see, and when you include the misdemeanors for which there's been a jury trial prayed, the vast majority of cases result in a probationary disposition. And that's where we try to work with people to try to get them on a right path over a long period of time. We fully understand that with a lot of people, there are, you know, two steps forward, one step back, and anyone that's had a family knows that, and anyone that's had a friend who's had a drug addiction problem knows that. you know, with respect to policy, there are certain crimes in Maryland for which there is a mandatory minimum sentence. And it's up to the state's attorney to decide whether to seek prosecution of a defendant for that particular crime. If there is a prosecution for that crime and there's a conviction, we are duty-bound to impose that mandatory minimum sentence in most cases. I have not read Michelle's book, but I do think much of what she speaks of is perhaps federal sentencing policy and the the federal sentencing guidelines that are perhaps would result in a much harsher sentence on Lombard Street than it would on Calvert Street.
Well, she also addresses nonviolent offenders who have
come
committed
before you all the time.
Who committed drug offenses. And I think one of the benefits we have as being judges in Baltimore City, having worked here, had a career here, and lived here, is sometimes you have to be creative about your resources in terms of not just what am I going to do with my sentencing, where am I going to send them to get help, and where are the resources that are out there. Now, Judge Avery's been in district court, and she was elevated to the circuit court. Her resources are great. But there's nothing that precludes a judge from picking up the phone and talking to somebody who's been on the bench for 17 years, like Wanda Hurd or Judge Audrey Carrion, or even Judge Karen Friedman, who have served in district court rotations, and say, you know, is this program any good? Do they have any open beds? And to be honest with you, my greatest resource are the assistant public defenders, because they're very familiar with the resources that are out there. They have relationships with their social workers in their office who press programs to get us open beds. But I also think your listeners really need to consider the report by the Justice Reinvestment Council that came out in December, where they really do a thorough analysis. And there was an op-ed piece in the Baltimore Sun recently by Paul DeWolf, who's the state public defender, and Scott Schellenberg from Baltimore County. They've done a thorough analysis, that committee, with all the stakeholders, where they actually talk about shifting our money from incarceration for nonviolent drug offenders to resources in the community, which would also serve people who have mental health issues.
So we're just about out of time, but Shannon, you want to have a final thought as well here before we wrap up in this first part of our program?
I would definitely commend the Maryland State Sentencing Commission for data and statistics on this in Baltimore City. And I know when I look around in my courtroom and in my colleagues' courtrooms that we are working with people to try to keep them out of jail. And that is our reality. We work with drug treatment programs, mental health programs, job training and placement programs, which there are a number now in Baltimore City that are very effective, as well as I would refer you to parenting classes and anger management and violence prevention programs, because these are also programs that we rely on to help people better themselves so that they don't have to go to jail. And that really is a last resort for us.
I think the whole umbrella, we would call it smart justice. And I think all of us try to impose smart justice in our courtrooms.
This has been a really interesting conversation. I hope our listeners are really paying attention to this as we look at the folks who are running for circuit court. We have the three of the sitting judges with us in this part of our program. You just heard Judge Michael DePietro. Before that, Judge Shannon Avery. Before that, Judge Cynthia Jones. All in the 8th Judicial Circuit running for election on April 26th. There are two contending this, six sitting judges running, and it's your choice to see who sits for the next 15 years. Good to have the three of you with us, and good luck.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
On way to break, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. Or go to steinershow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We continue our conversation with the circuit court judges who are running to retain their jobs as judges of the city. This half hour, we're talking with Judge Karen Chaya Friedman and Judge Audrey J.S. Carrion and Judge Wanda Keys Hurd, and welcome to have all three of you.
Thank you.
With us.
It's great to be here.
Having us.
Thank you.
So let's begin. I began this way, I think, with the others, and I just wanted to ask you this question. There's such a heated battle going on, and people going back and forth in, say, legislature about whether or not judges should be running for office. And I was some interesting in the mayoral reporter I want to bring up as well during the course of this, and some other questions that people actually texted to me earlier when they heard that I was doing this today. I don't want to throw out at you as well. But what about this idea? I mean, this is the question: how you feel about judges standing for election? Some people, of course, argue that it is dangerous because you have to take money from lawyers who have to appear in front of you. Not saying you're unethical human beings. I'm just saying that is something that is raised. Others saying this is the only way that many women and people of color can end up in as judges, given the nature of our system. So, what are your thoughts on even having to run for office, Judge Carrion?
Well, it is the law of the state of Maryland, and I have no objection to it. There are some intangibles to running for office, and that is the opportunity to be able to meet with community members. And what we have done is that we've taken that opportunity to educate our citizens here in the residents here of Baltimore City of what we do as judges and why it is that we have to run for office. I agree with you, however, that the fundraising part of it is something that is not appealing to us, but it's necessary. Because of that reason, we have a financial committee, a special committee, who takes care of us to take care of that issue for the sitting judges.
We also have a comment on that?
Well, I agree with Judge Carrion that going out into the community is a definite advantage to the process. It lets us leave the courtrooms and leave our chambers and go to places and speak to people that normally we would not be in touch with. And because during the regular time, when we're not up for election, we really have prohibitions as far as what we can do and what we can say, and we're really not political beings. And then all of a sudden now we have this opportunity to really get out there and, you know, shake hands and really see what's going on in the community. The argument of that in the past the election process was necessary in order to create diversity on the bench is a very valid argument, but I think it is important to note at this point that we, all six of us, are the product of appointments. And if you look at our ticket, I mean, we're five women now. We're two African-American females. We're a Jewish Orthodox female, the first ever appointed. We are a Hispanic woman. So we are a very diverse ticket, and we are the product of appointment. So, you know, there is an argument to be made that historically it was necessary, but perhaps now the appointments are diverse. But, you know, there are arguments to be made both ways.
Tushar, do you want to add to that at all?
No, I think that's really the point. I've been on the bench since 99. I remember a time practicing law where there were no judges that looked like me until Judge Hubbard became a judge in the 80s. She was one of the first African-American women appointed to the district court and then to the circuit court for Baltimore City. So that was definitely a difference. I would also note that Baltimore City isn't the only jurisdiction. You see, the law applies to every
right.
circuit court in every jurisdiction of the state. And in some of those areas, diversity is not so clear. And so the idea that the opportunity exists to allow individuals to run. In many instances, you have individuals who've run, applied in the past and been overlooked. That still exists. So it's a twofold process. You go through the vetting process, you are appointed by the governor, and then you run. It's sort of like a blessing by the community that you serve. And to the extent that that also affords lawyers the opportunity to put their hat in the ring and not go through the vetting process, that is the law. And we welcome our challengers. And we also welcome the fact that we have very deep experience in the law and in our community in terms of our service. So I'm kind of in the sort of in the category, I like the law the way it is. Although I might like a retention election. If you've run once before, sort of like the Court of Appeals and the Court of Special Appeals, that you shouldn't have to run again against challengers, but rather have a retention election.
There are two challenges in this race.
There are.
And we've interviewed one so far of those challengers. Very quickly, because I really want to get to the heart of some issues here. And one email that somebody sent me when they heard we were doing having the three of you on. And it's not an easy question, but I'll throw it out there to you all. But does it make a difference, do you think, being a woman on the bench? Is it being a man on the bench? Being a woman who's Puerto Rican or black or Orthodox Jewish? Is it interesting that they have this kind of diversity in the city like this and this running? Does that make a difference, do you think?
I think you can't deny where you come from, right? That doesn't make any sense. You bring who you are to the bench. That's the whole point of being diverse. But you should, and you do make decisions based on the evidence and the law that it's applicable, and you be
right.
You're fair and impartial. But you won't take away from Audrey Carrion's experience, because I am a person as well, and so I bring with me that experience and that diversity, and the fact that I was raised in spending the summers with my grandmother in the Bronx in New York, and the things that I saw. That I lived in Puerto Rico and what I saw there, and I bring that experience, the fact that I speak two languages. That is who I am, and you can't deny it. So I think that who you are is who you are at the bench, with the understanding that you are always – you make the pledge to follow the law.
And Pat, want to jump in on that?
I mean, I definitely agree. And, you know, we are still a pool. Even though we sit individually, we are a pool of experiences and knowledge. And if I have, you know, certain issues that maybe I am not – don't have experience with, whether it's, you know, English as a second language issues. I know that I can reach out to Judge Carrion and say, hey, I'm having this issue and could you help me with this? Because I know that she has knowledge of it. You know, if there are issues of, you know, like you brought up the Orthodox Jew, you know, if there are issues of Sabbath observance or holiday observance, you know, around the high holiday times, mm-hmm. the bench looks to me to say, okay, Carrion, which days – you know, can people sit on jury duties? Which day they can? Which days do we have to release them early? Having me on the bench allows them to draw my experience. So everyone brings to the bench their own experiences, and we as a community of judges can reach out and lean on each other to share those experiences and knowledge.
You want to jump in on that as well, Judge?
I'm just going to say ditto, but you are not going to get – greater or fewer cases because you're a woman.
Oh, no, right.
Or you're
right.
African-American.
No.
So
everyone,
the dock is going to stay the same and you're expected to do the same amount of work. But as my colleagues have pointed out, as lawyers, as judges, we have our area of specialty and expertise. And that's part of what our credentials and our qualifications speak to. Whether we're women or African-American, whether we're Orthodox or Hispanic, each of us have the depth of our knowledge and experience that is what brought us to the bench, which allowed for the appointment process, which was part of what we were questioned on when we applied and when we were screened. And when you walk into the courtroom, I'm hopeful that you're going to see a fair judge sitting in front of you, male, female, black or white, but that's what you're going to expect, that judge is going to be prepared, respectful, knowledgeable, and have a proper temperament.
Temperament is a huge issue here. I mean, not with you all necessarily, but it's a huge issue for people on the bench, I think, that having that certain temperament. This is a question that came up, I think, at one of the forums you were in, and someone sent me a note about this, and I just want to throw this out at you again. I noticed that one of your opponents is Todd Oppenheim, a public defender, that the six judges who are running in this race have recused themselves from hearing cases that he, if he's the defense attorney in the court. Some people have argued that, well, should you also recuse yourself in cases of people who have written checks to the campaign, who are also lawyers? I mean, that may be standing in front of you. I mean, that is there a difference between the two? Because one, you've recused yourself, the others you're not. And is that an issue?
Well, Mr. Oppenheim is running against us.
Yes.
So that's a big difference. and secondly, it is, you know, the recusal issue is about the client. It is about not Mr. Oppenheim, but about the client and making sure that the client has no question at all that the person who's going to be trying their case or hearing the motion is going to be fair and impartial. And I guarantee that notwithstanding the fact that he is – that Mr. Oppenheim is running against us, that he would. But that we all would be fair and impartial. Mm-hmm. But it's their appearance of impropriety because he is running against us. And so we all individually, I believe, decided, you know what, the best thing is to recuse ourselves while we're running against each other. He has an absolute right to run against us, and that's fine. But during that period of time, we've decided to recuse ourselves. And it's based on his clients, not on us individually.
Sir, do you want to add?
I totally agree. I'm still in the criminal division, and one of the routines that occurs in the criminal division is plea negotiation. 95% of our cases are resolved by plea bargaining. And what I was concerned of when I decided to recuse myself was that plea bargaining process, that if Mr. Oppenheim wanted some particular deal for his client and I didn't agree, I didn't want the perception that I wasn't agreeing because he was running against me. You know, the average layperson might not understand that dynamic. And as Judge Caron has said, it's the client that's the most important thing, not Mr. Oppenheim. And so we have a code of ethics. And if we do anything that gives the appearance of impropriety, that runs contrary to the code. And for that reason, I recuse myself. And I do that cautiously. Mm-hmm. And I've, in 17 years, very rarely had an occasion to do that. Even when I ran last time, it's a very unusual thing to do. However, Mr. Oppenheimer has been very, very vocal about negative comments directed at our bench as a whole. And specifically because we are running, and these comments, in our view, are not accurate depictions of who we are as judges or individuals. I also think that that is so very important, that there not be any confusion about what we're doing when we're sitting in judge of an individual who's expecting fairness and justice before the law. And so in an abundance of caution, I've chosen to recuse myself for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything my colleague says. A few things. One is that, you know, Mr. Oppenheim's made a very big deal about this, but I think he also should be clear that only one of us are sitting in criminal right now, which is Judge Hurd. So he's making this big to-do when it only really has one judge that has to recuse him, herself from him. The rest of us are either in family or civil, which he does not appear in front of. So it's not really a big to-do like he's making.
And I take it as a compliment. I mean, obviously he wants to get in my courtroom, so I must be a really good judge that he's so upset that he can't get his cases in front of me. I'm honored that he thinks so highly of me that he wants to get in my courtroom. But as I said before, in all fairness to his clients, I think it's best that we not confuse in any way any politics in the courtroom. It really isn't appropriate.
And it's inaccurate, though, to say that we're not recusing ourselves from donors' cases. I know several of my colleagues have had situations where they did reveal, I believe it was a civil cases. I mean, I'm in family, so it's mostly pro se litigants, so I don't have to worry about it.
But our colleagues in
civil have said, you know, I'd like, you know, counsel to know that this attorney has made me a fundraiser and has revealed it and has asked the other counsel, you know, do you want me to recuse myself based on this information? So to say that we're not addressing it or when it comes to our donors is not accurate either.
No.
So
it has been I personally had a situation that I had to do that, and I followed the rule which requires for me to advise counsel. In fact, we did it the afternoon before the hearing. And we did it in open court in front of their clients. And then pursuant to the rule, I left the bench to give counsel an opportunity to speak in private with their clients. They went ahead and did that. They both came back and said, Judge Caron, we have no objection to it. And that makes sense because, frankly, I'm not changing an opinion based on someone buying a ticket to a breakfast or anything, frankly.
So one of the things we just briefly talked about and didn't get any depth in it before we came on the air, at least Judge Carey and I did, was a question of judicial activism came up as a question. I want to ask a question about that. One of the biggest, from my perspective of covering criminal justice and the courts with some intensity over the last 23 years on the air, is the question of bail and bail reform in our community. And I know that the district courts probably do more than you do, but you also hear at least twice a week issues about around bail. And one of the biggest issues here are the numbers of people brought in and arrested on charges, and many nonviolent offenders who are on charges that stay in jail a month, more, 2 months before the trials come up, losing jobs, family issues, and all the rest that happen to people who come in. And whether there's a role for judges here to be activists, since it is a legislative issue, but whether you can be activists in terms of dealing with bail, given that most of the clients that you face, especially in criminal court, are poor working people and poor working black people in the city who are the ones filling up our jails. So your thoughts on that? I mean, this is, to me, I think one of the most important issues around.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think it's important to realize that 98% of the bails are done in district court. So our opponents keep talking about bail. You are very.
I'm not saying that because I'm
reading. I understand. But first of all, it's important to know. Now, Judge Carrion and I have both sat in the district court, so I have done hundreds and hundreds of bails in my years there. Okay, bail is probably the most difficult decision that a judge makes. It is exceptionally difficult, and the reason why is because there are two things that a judge needs to look at when deciding a bail. Two things: one, risk of flight. Two, danger to the community. Those are the two factors that we really have to focus on. So really what you're asking a judge to do practically is to be psychic and say, okay, based on this person's past behavior, do I believe that he is a flight risk? And do I believe that he's a danger to the community? For flight risk, you're looking at past failure to appear. They're going to tell you when they review his history how many times in the past he has not shown up to court. Danger to the community, we're looking at past convictions and are they nonviolent offenses or violent offenses? And the current offense, is the current offense a violent offense? So it's a very, very difficult determination for a judge to make because you really are asking them to predict the future, okay? So that's one thing that people need to understand, that what judges are doing. Another thing that judges, that people have to realize, and people especially in the media have to realize, in my opinion, is that what the media does is you look very critically at the bails. But then if, God forbid, someone's out on my bail, or I recog someone and that person on my bail commits a murder or hurts somebody, do you know what the byline's going to be the next day, right? Mr. X, out on Judge Friedman's bail, committed a murder. That's what your byline's going to be. No one's going to go back and evaluate if my bail was correct.
I think what I'm just, let me throw out to the other two judges here, and Judge Hurd and Judge Carrion as well. I mean, but I think that begs the question, though, about the justice in our bail, the lack of justice inside of our bail system, and our money bail system, and how it affects people and what roles you can play in that.
But that's the point. We are talking about what's done in district court. The judges that are running for circuit court. And we don't see bail review. That's not our job. In fact, it is only occurring on Tuesdays and Fridays at the circuit court, and only in two different scenarios: an appeal from a decision made by a district court judge on a bail, and what we call a habeas corpus petition. That's where a lawyer representing a defendant sees what the bail is, decides it's too high, and in a sense files a request because the defendant's maybe been indicted and now has to make a bail that's been preset by the state's attorney's office. Because, by the way, the state's attorney's office sometimes, when they indict, they set a preset bail. And so that attorney has the right to ask for a review of that bail by a circuit court judge. That happens on Tuesdays and Fridays. And I've been on the bench for 17 years. I haven't sat in bail review court in over 7 years. It's not something that the average circuit court judge does. And when we do, it's only in this limited capacity of a review of a bail that has been previously set. It is not a situation we are reviewing and setting a bail initially ourselves. We're at the circuit court, not the district court. And so when our opponents start talking about changing the bail system and setting a bail, my question is, the review, the standard of review of that district court bail has legal limits. You can't just decide, Judge Hurd walks in the door and says, oh, I don't like that bail that Judge X in district court said, I'm going to change it, and summarily just change a bail. I've had attorneys say to me at arraignment, can I get a bail review? And I say, file your request, and the hearings are held on Tuesdays and Fridays, and in that petition, you must lay out the basis why you believe the bail that was set in the district court should be overturned or changed. And there are rules governing that, statutory rules governing that. So I think that that's a lot of what is confusing to many listeners, that they don't realize that this is not just a role that all judges have.
Right.
The circuit court judges are limited.
There's another way in which we review bails, and those are the bails that we set for violation of probation. In those cases, we're intimately familiar with who our probationers are, and we look at the reasons why they are before us for a violation of probation. But I agree with what Judge Friedman and Judge Hurd just said. It's very, very limited, the numbers of times that we have reviewed bails. And I've been in the circuit court for 15 years, and maybe on one or two occasions I've sat on the rotation to review bails.
At a meeting at a forum, our opponent suggested, when someone asked him the question, well, you're running for circuit court, why do you, you're talking about something that's done in district court. And he just suggested that sua sponte, circuit court judges should review bails from the district court judges. And it doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. Legally, as Judge Hurd said, the lawyers have to ask for the hearing and they have to meet criteria. Mm-hmm. We just can't reach down to the district court and pick up things that we don't like and review them. It just doesn't work.
It's more of a legislative issue.
We only have about a minute left, so I just want to have a final thought here from you all before you all have to run back to the bench and we have to conclude the conversation. You're about to say what, Judge Cameron?
No, it is a legislative issue.
Right.
So, if our opponents want to change it, then become legislators and do it.
So, folks, April 26th is the date of the primary election, the date when and the district will be on both Republican and Democratic lines when you go to vote in the primary. And this is your choice to make. You've heard this half an hour from Judge Audrey J.S. Carrion, who is with us in the studio, Judge Cameron Chaya Friedman, and Judge Wanda Keys Hurd. Thank the three of you so much for your service and for coming into the studio today.
Thank you so very much for having us.